Okay, so we're going to continue the discussion of finite horizon and infinite horizon, and also indefinite horizon. Okay, so we talked about finite horizon Markov addition processes last class. Before I go forward, are there any questions? Yes. What?
We haven't finished those, the MDP
parts. Yeah, as I said, when the stochastic shortest path MDPs are over, which is the indefinite horizon,
okay,
then that's when, a week from then,
okay,
you know, basically that's when the MDPs are done.
Sure.
Okay? Good. Other questions? Also, I mentioned to you guys that I set a, I mean, I gave a schedule, approximate schedule of the, you know, the topics that we plan to cover, the classes and the topics we expect to cover. I think all the topics are not written yet, but you know, I think the schedule will become more fleshed out as we go forward. The essential idea is that I would try to follow, unless I change too much, I more or less will be following what I did last time. So the videos from the last time are still possible. I think they would still make sense. And I am actually, as I said last time, in the last class, I have started recording these slide videos. If that is of any use to you, you can use them. Of course, you know, you get everything in the class, that's good too. Okay, so that's, and then, you know, make sure that you go to the class page, the 2013 page, because that will have the information about the actual dates and so on. And I also mentioned a tentative midterm date on that. Okay. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so we talked about finite horizon Markov addition processes, which basically start with this idea of starting with V0 and then continuing on to compute V1 from V0, V2 from V1, and so on. We looked at that. So this is how it looks like. I'm just repeating it. You know, you have V0 here. V0 is just the immediate reward of each of the states. And then from V0, what did I do? Okay, I went back. Okay, from V0, I'll get V1, and then basically in doing V1, I consider for a particular state, let's say in this case, there are two different actions. And then for each of those actions, I know the state they will get me to. And then once I do that action, I only have zero time left. And so I'll basically take the V0 as the remaining, you know, value from there onwards. And then using that idea, I compute what do I get if I take the red function, the red action, and then what do I take if I take the yellow action. And then I wrote both the red and yellow actions, the expected values here, okay? And then I'm taking the max of those and then adding the reward of this particular state that will give me V1 of that state, okay? And basically the same way, I have to compute V1 for this state, V1 for this state, V1 for this state. And having computed V1 for every one, then I can get to compute V2, then I get to compute V3, and so on. Okay, now how far do I go back? It's the horizon that I have in mind. You know, in this particular case, I have horizon 3, and so I just go 3 steps back. Okay, so basically, then, you know, having kept that in mind, so one thing that you want to remember is that we are indeed using the dynamic programming in computing this particular optimal value function from which you compute the optimal policy. The way you're using dynamic programming is that you are using value function to k minus 1 stages to go in computing the value function for k stages to go. So 0 is used to compute 1, 1 is used to compute 2, 2 is used to compute 3, and so on. Okay. This is basically where we are essentially using the Markovness of the Markov addition processes. because the value that you can get from a state onwards depends only on how long you have to live from that state, not how you got to that state. Do you see what I'm saying? So that's why if you are computing V8 based on V7, at the time you computed V7, you don't quite know how you would get to this state, a particular state, seven stages to go. I could have come from this state, I could have come from this state. Irrespective of how I get here, if I get here, then I only get V7 of that state. So value function, seven stages to go of that state. So that's where the Markovness is being used. Okay, so the path doesn't matter. All that matters is, you know, the state. Okay, and then of course, because we have finite horizon, the policy is non-stationary. Okay. What am I doing here? Okay, I don't know why we are doing this. Yeah. Okay. And then the computational complexity is interesting because we actually came to this thinking the worst brute force way to do this would be look at all the policies and compare them in terms of their in terms of the value they provide. So each policy corresponds to a value function, a value vector. And you say one policy dominates another policy if its value vector is strictly larger than the other guy's, larger than the other guy's value vector. And one vector is considered to be larger than the other vector if this vector is, for each corresponding terms, this vector has a value that's always greater than or equal to this one. And there exists at least one guy for which it's actually strictly greater. Okay, so we basically are before we looked at this dynamic programming algorithm, we basically assumed that we would have to do work that is proportional to the number of distinct policies, and the number of distinct policies was quite high. If you remember, how much was the number of distinct policies? It's A power S T. So you had to do something of the order of that. Okay, having set yourself, you know, up to this, then it looks like anything else looks good, right? So this is, this one is exponential in the number of states. By the way, the n here really is nothing but the number of states. Okay, so if you look at what we are doing, we are essentially doing, if the t is the number of, if t is the horizon, then you do t iterations. And in each iteration, you have n states, or basically s number of states. And you're computing for each state the expectation for a action. Remember, for every state, you consider all the actions you can do, and for each action, the expected value that you can get back. Right? Okay. And then each expectation takes O n time, because you can essentially go to any of the states. These actions can take you to the other states in the next level. Okay, so the total time complexity is that. That is T times A times N square, or S square. Okay, which looks great if you are essentially expecting this, because this is exponential in the number of states. It's pretty sucky if you actually realize that any realistic problem, the number of states can be very, very high. So to be polynomial in the number of states is not something that you want to write home about. Do you see what I'm saying? It's in fact, this is something that you want to keep in mind. For those of you again who remember remember the STRIPS planning from 471, notice that in the case of STRIPS planning, you essentially, let's say you would wind up having V state variables. Okay, if you have V state variables, then you have 2 power v states, and now you are saying essentially that you are polynomial in 2 power v, which means it's exponential in the number of state variables. So the question is, where do you put yourself in? Okay, by the way, I hope you understand that computational complexity is always in terms of the input. Okay, So if you give, if you think of your input as the number of states, it looks only polynomial complexity. If you think of your input as a compact input, where which is in terms of the state variables, then the number of states is 2 power v, and polynomial in 2 power v is exponential in v. Okay, you want to keep this in mind. In fact, I know there's a couple of you from operations research, in industrial engineering department here. And one interesting thing is that MDPs actually came from OR community. Okay, Ron Howard called himself an OR guy, okay, operations research guy. He basically, in one interesting difference in the way MDPs got looked at in operations research versus AI, is that in operations research, people think that they'll take a problem, spend a lot of time carefully deciding what's the least number of states we can get away with. So they will come up with a representation for the problem such that the number of states is very small. And so if it's polynomial in the number of states, it's not too bad. Okay, in AI, we tend to look at, first of all, people tend to essentially allow generalized representation. So you might have, for example, large number of irrelevant state variables. So for example, picking the right state representation means figuring out exactly what aspects of the problem are relevant and what are not relevant, and making sure that you remove all the irrelevant stuff yourself, you the human who modeled the problem. By doing this, you can make the number of states very small, and then it's only polynomial in that. AI people tend to look at the they use the same model, but they tend to assume that we look for generalized representations where we throw in all the state variables that we know. Some of them are relevant, some are irrelevant. You are supposed to figure out what is relevant, what's irrelevant. You being the intelligent agent. Okay. Now, if I basically then, so let's say I'll just throw in the same 10,000 state variables for everybody, or same, 100 state variables for everybody. In which case, suddenly now I'm talking about 2 power 100 states. And now I'm talking about polynomial in the 2 power 100 states. All of a sudden, it doesn't look all that good. It's the same complexity result. AI people look at this and see, oh my God, what a sad story. And OR people will look at it and say, that's pretty nice. It's polynomial. You see what I'm saying? It's a question of what kind of problems you're trying to solve and how much human effort is being put into, modeling the problem. Here's another interesting point to keep in mind since I've gotten into this OR versus AI thing. OR, operations research people, essentially sell employees. They, train students, and they say, you hire our students, that our student will listen to your problem, figure out what's the best way to model it, either for MDP or for integer programming or whatever else. These things are such big things that normal people cannot touch them, highly, these are caricatures, of course. Highly trained PhD, MS students will be able to help you. That's the model with which operations research works. So it's reasonable that you're paying money to somebody and they'll spend a lot of time figuring out what's the smallest state space that you can get away with. AI people, of course, are essentially cutting the branch they're sitting on because we are trying to automate everything. Right? We don't sell employees. We sell technology. We sell technology which eventually remove the need for employees. So that's why, in essence, you are essentially coming up with, anybody should be able to write models for MDPs. And they are likely to write bad models. And so they're likely to have very large sized models. And then, so we would spend a lot of time figuring out how to essentially automatically figure out, and automatically reduce the state space sizes. Okay? Anyway, so, but the same problem has been, looked at from two different directions. It's the mathematically, it's exactly the same problem. It's a question of what do you want to do with it. Okay? So anyway, so this is the polynomial result. It looks kind of good. Okay, but it's really exponential result from the point of view of state variables. The complexity is exponential, not polynomial, from the state variables point of view. Yes?
Why is n square?
Because you have n states, and each state's expectation takes n. For each state, you are considering all the actions, and those actions are going into all possible states. Okay? So, that's basically the value iteration for finite horizon MDPs. And you know, when if you compute this MDP by this backward dynamic programming, then you will get the optimal policy. Yeah.
But the number can be larger than N squared.
What?
The previous thing, the N squared, number can be larger than.
What does that mean? What number?
You're restricting to the N squared value.
No, N is the number of states.
Yeah. So why a square of
that? This is basically, so this is your reasoning, right? There are t iterations, and each iterations at each of the n states, you need to compute the expectation. The expectation computation itself takes order n time. Okay? That's what you need to convince yourself. This is only a worst case complexity. It's not average case, it's not the optimized, you know. It's the worst case complexity. Okay, so then you have, you know, basically, you have to convince yourself that, you know, what we are doing in this case does give you the optimal policy. I mean, by construction, it should be reasonably obvious that we are getting optimal policy of k stages to go. Okay? And then one other thing that you want to remember is the optimal value function is unique, but optimal policy is not unique. Okay? Because multiple policies might wind up going to the same value function. Now, if you remember, like the, I think I may have mentioned this last time too, but if you remember one of the examples that we had originally, if as you keep changing the reward function, you get different behaviors. In one case, we basically said the value, the action in each state can be any of the four. If you say the action in a particular state can be any of the four, they're all equally good. That means you're essentially talking about four possible policies. Do you understand what I'm saying? If it turns out that there are, you know, huge number of states in one particular state in the optimal policy, it doesn't really matter which action you do. Okay? In which case, essentially, there are four optimal policies. I mean, if there are four actions. Okay? That's why the number of policies, the value function is optimal. So value function is unique, but the policies are not unique. In fact, there is this interesting connection between policy values and policies, value function and policy. And you keep seeing this. In a minute, actually, we'll get to the policy iteration algorithm where we actually wind up using this. So given a value function, you can convert it into a policy by taking greedy policy. Right? We talked about it last time. Given any value function, you can compute the greedy policy, which is basically saying for each state, pick the action that according to this value function would be the best action. To do that, you compute the expected value for each of the actions from this state and pick the max. That would be the greedy policy. Remember this whole thing about exploration, exploitation that we discussed last time? Okay? So given any value function, there's a greedy policy. Now what's interesting is that if you given a policy, you can compute the value function. This becomes even clearer as we go to the infinite horizon MDP. So because of this non-uniqueness, because multiple policies might correspond to the same value function, for example, it turns out that you can start from a value function, you can compute the greedy policy, and given that policy, compute the value, and that will be a new value function now. Okay, with respect to which now you compute the policy and you can compute the value, and if you do this, you're going from policy to policy to policy. And that's the policy iteration algorithm. We'll get to it in detail in a minute. The only thing, of course, is are there a specific value policy function such that they are essentially connected to each other? That means you go from value, you get to the policy, and then you go from that policy, you go back to the same value. That will only happen at the V star and pi star. If in fact, you know, our policy is the optimal policy is unique, then given V star, the greedy policy with respect to V star is pi star. And the value function of pi star is V star. Only there it is fixed point. Up until then, you can actually jump from one value to a policy to its value to its policy to its value to its policy until you reach V star pi star. That's what actually happens in the policy iteration algorithm. Okay? But policy iteration doesn't make sense for finite horizon mock iteration processes. It actually, we'll talk about it with respect to infinite horizon mock iteration processes. Okay. Now we are so this is all the discussion I'm going to do about finite horizon. Are there any further questions on this stuff? Okay. So next we are talking about infinite horizon. We already talked about it last time, but I'm just going to go through it quickly once. So you are now considering situation where there is no bound on the horizon. So the horizon is infinite. So you can live infinitely long. You can do infinite number of actions. So, and to do that, basically to even support the definition of a reasonable optimal policy in that case, you want to make sure that the value of a state is not going to become infinite. Value of a state with respect to a policy doesn't become infinite. Okay. First of all, you realize that the moment you are infinite horizon, as we talked about from the last couple of classes, you will only have a stationary policy for an infinite horizon MDP, because it does not make sense to talk about non-stationary policy, because it's always the number of steps you have left to go is always infinite. Even if you lived billion years, you still have billion more, I mean infinite number of years to go, if you assume you had infinite number of years to begin with, right? Infinite number of epochs to begin with. Okay, so there's only, we're talking about a finite, we're talking about a stationary policy, and we also want to make sure that given an arbitrary policy, it's not going to give infinite values to all the states. If it does, then there is no notion of optimal policy, because every random policy will be having infinities all over the states, and so all of them are equally good or bad. Right? To avoid that, one trick that we basically do is we essentially discount future rewards with respect to the current state, and that's what we are doing here. So you essentially take expectation not of just the sum of the rewards, but expectation of discounted rewards, expectation of the sum of the discounted rewards, where the discount factor is beta. Okay, what did I do? Oh, okay, I'm sorry, this happened again. It'll take a minute. Okay. So there's a, okay, that'll take a minute, but let's just continue. So if you have a discount factor beta, then we are essentially considering beta power t, rt sum. Now, as long as beta is between 0 and strictly 0 less than or equal to beta less than 1, this would be a geometric sequence. Okay? And furthermore, so essentially I have something like this, beta power 0, r0, plus beta power 1, r1, plus beta power 2, R2, plus etc. Okay, this R1 is the reward you got in the first state that you got into, R2 is the reward you got in the second state you got into, and so on. So this would be, now this beta itself is being squared, cubed, and so on. So you have a nice, what looks like a, basically a power series. Now of course the only difference is this is R0, this is R1, this is R2, etc. The one thing that we did say is the reward function is always finite. The immediate reward you get in any state is finite. That means it has to be bounded. Okay, if it has to be bounded, then there is a maximum reward you can ever get. So you take all the states and pick the max reward from all those states, that let's call that R max. Right? Then if I were to consider this beta power 0 R max plus beta power 1 R max, beta power n R max, right? Okay, this, how does this correspond to this? How does this relate to this? This sum is an upper bound. right? Because I'm assuming everywhere I'm getting the maximum reward. The nice thing about this is now I can remove Rmax, and it's like 1 plus beta square, blah, blah, blah. That's 1 by 1 minus beta. That's the geometric series. Right? So what that means is by putting a beta discount factor, I ensured that the maximum reward I can ever get from any state, maximum cumulative reward I can ever get from any state is R max by 1 minus beta. Okay, earlier I already said that we need this to beta to make things finite, but we know actually exactly how finite they become. We have an actual bound on anybody's value function. Okay? So the next thing is, with this discounted reward function, with the discounting of future states, we can talk about optimal policies with respect to infinite horizon Markov rotation processes. Okay, and so the optimal policy would be stationary. It has to be stationary because, as I said, it would not be non-stationary, and then the number of policies you have is going to be only a power s. It's not a power s times t, because the t doesn't matter anymore. Of these a power s policies, there is a optimal policy, and the optimal policy corresponds to the optimal value. Okay. In discussing this, assume basically, until I show you the difference, that the value function and policy in the infinite case are connected to each other the same way they are connected to each other in the finite case. There are some important differences, but you know, the analogy that you want to keep in your mind is basically you had an example already of how value and policy are connected. Okay. So now how do I compute? So in fact, there are actually two different issues. One is, given a policy, how do I compute its value? And the second is, how do I directly compute optimal value? If I compute the optimal value function, then I can compute the optimal policy directly. Okay, actually, even though this is my next slide, let me actually go forward and show you how to evaluate a policy, and then we'll come back. This is actually the simpler, this is the simpler point. How do I evaluate a policy? If I have a policy pi for an infinite horizon Markov rotation process, okay, and if it turns out that its value function is v of pi, then I can argue to my, I basically convince myself that essentially that v pi of S must be related to V pi of the neighbor F dash. Notice this particular equation looks almost like the one that we wrote for the finite horizon, except there you would have said V pi of K steps would be related to V pi of K minus 1 steps. Since K is infinity, K and K minus 1 are the same. That means V pi of S is related to V pi of F dash, where F dash are its neighbors, where neighbors are defined in terms of the actions That means if you can get to that state S dash by taking an action A, then that's enabled. So basically V pi of S is R of S, which is the reward for that state, plus you can, you know, for in this particular case, if you are in S, pi of S tells you what action to do in that state S, right? Because you have a policy. So pi of S tells you what action to do. So then if you do that action in state S, then T of S pi S S dash tells you the probability that you'll get into S dash after doing the action that the policy is asking you to do. With that probability, you will now get into S dash, and then you will experience the value of S dash, which is V pi of S dash. Agreed? So if I give you this, do you now see that you can directly convert a policy into a value function? It looks, you know, maybe menacing for some of you, but it's really a set of linear equations, simultaneous linear equations. How many unknown variables are there? N unknown variables. V pi of S1, V pi of S2, etc., V pi of Sn. N unknown variables. And there are going to be N equations on these N unknown variables. What's more, the equations are all going to be linear. They're all going to be linear. So you just solve the set of linear equations to get the N unknowns. Okay? Basically, you can do matrix inversion, you can do, you know, Gauss-Jordan elimination, anything you feel like. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay? So this is the minimum you want to understand. Actually, this is actually the easy case. So if we know the rewards and we know the probabilities, then it's basically what we have is a simple linear system with n variables and n equations, and so you can use linear algebra to solve this problem. Okay, now having looked at this, let's consider what will happen if I am not given pi. So this basically, if all I have is this, what would I do? I would essentially consider for each policy, I compute the value this way. There are only A power S policies. Loop. For each policy in A power S policies, compute the value function using linear algebra. And then find the max of the value vectors. And the pi that gave you the max value function is the maximum, is the best pi. Get it? Okay, that's the brute force. You should always understand the brute force one so that you can appreciate when you get a better version. Okay? Now, the question is, can we avoid doing that? It's the same sort of question we had previously, right? So can we avoid this idea of having to actually go through all the policies? Well, of course you can, if you can somehow realize that whatever is the policy pi, in state S, any given policy can differ only in terms of which action it asks you to do in that state S. If there are total of cap, you know, A actions that you can do in any state, then all you want to do is compute this expectation for all each of those A actions, take the max over them, and say, that's what I want. That's what we did in the finite horizon. You see what I'm saying? Okay? So all I'll wind up doing is go from this, keep this in mind, go from this to that. Where am I? Oh yeah, okay. Okay. It's the same, the equation almost looks exactly like the previous equation. Okay. The only difference is in this case, I am considering all possible actions. Previously, I only considered the action that corresponded to pi of S. Now I'm considering all possible actions because I don't have a single policy. I'm considering what's the best policy. And I'm picking the best policy by picking the action for each of the states. However, although I'm computing the policy, what I will wind up doing right now is I'm essentially going to compute the value function upfront. And the value function, just like the value function with respect to pi is related of a state, is related to value function with respect to pi of the neighboring state, just like that, the optimal value function for a state S is related to the optimal value function of its neighboring state. And this equation is giving you the relation. The only difference is, unlike the previous equation which got you a bunch of linear equations, now you have a nonlinear set of equations because you have a max operator thrown in. So you can't directly solve this using linear algebra. Actually, there are ways, people, you know, familiar with IP and, you know, basically people familiar with linear programming can find a way of writing this as a set of linear equations. You know, those of you who don't know linear programming, I won't get into it. Okay, you can write this into a set of linear, linear equations, and then so basically generate a linear programming formulation. Okay, for those of you who know linear programming, that also explains to you why this problem is polynomial. Linear programming is polynomial. If you had to convert it into IP, then this problem must be possibly exponential. Okay, the fact that one way you can actually show that finding the optimal policy for infinite horizon mass rotation processes is a polynomial problem is to show that you can solve it by translating it into a linear programming formulation. And since we know LP is polynomial, this problem must be polynomial. Cute? Actually, that's the only way to prove this, it turns out. It turns out that solving this set of equations, actually, if you just look at it this way, you know, it's not clear whether you can solve this in, you know, polynomial amount of time. But by converting it into a linear programming formulation, you can solve it into a polynomial amount of time. However, we won't solve it that way. We will instead solve these equations by essentially just picking a value function, initializing a value function V0 for every state. It doesn't matter what you pick as the initial value function. A reasonable idea is to assume that the value function of each state is its immediate reward. But it's only an approximation. And then compute, so V0 is the zeroth iteration value function. Compute first iteration value function in terms of the zeroth iteration value function. Compute second iteration value function in terms of the first iteration value function. And keep doing this until the value functions between two iterations don't change too much. What does change too much mean? The maximum difference between these two value functions is bounded by some epsilon. That's basically what is called value iteration. Okay? Okay? So the optimal value function is a fixed point on the Bellman backup, where Bellman backup is that particular operation. Okay, and so essentially, to compute, since it's a fixed point, you can start with any arbitrary, you know, initial guess for the value function, and you can keep updating it using the Bellman backup. And it will converge to the optimal value function. The nice part, of course, is why does it converge? And that's basically because Bellman backup function has a property called the contraction property. We'll look at it in a minute. And the contraction property says that if you have two value functions, V1 and V2, okay, if you apply Bellman backup for both V1 and V2, you would get BV1 and BV2. If you consider the distance between V1 and V2, where the distance is in terms of max norm, that means pick the dimension at which they are maximally different and take the absolute value. Okay? So what you can show essentially is that, I'll show that in a minute, but what you can show essentially is that V1, the this is the max norm of V1 minus V2. So the distance between V1 and V2. Now, if I consider Bellman operation on V1, okay, and then consider Bellman operation on V2, and take the max norm of that, that is guaranteed to be less than or equal to beta times the original max norm. Beta is a number less than 1. So you keep driving down the maximum distance between these two vectors as you keep updating this value function. That's your mathematical proof. Okay? To prove this, essentially, you basically have to show yourself that the contraction property holds for the Bellman operation, Bellman backup. But before I go there, okay, before I go there, let's just first make sure that we understand what we need to do as value iteration. So value iteration is, you could, for example, in this case, I just put V0 s equal to 0. So I just put 0 for everybody. Okay, but in fact, you could put V0 s equal to R of s, which is probably a better idea. And even better, you can put, by the way, and then I'll come back to this in later, if you have some idea of how good the value of states is, let's say call that H of s, heuristic of s, I can set V0 s equal to H of s. Okay? And then Vk of s is defined in terms of Vk minus 1 of s. Now this part looks exactly like the finite domain, I mean finite horizon Markov addition processes. The only difference is the semantics for k minus 1 and k in the previous case was the number of steps you have left to live. Here there is no such actual semantics. It's just the current approximation, kth approximation. Kth approximation is computed from the k minus 1th approximation. That's it. Okay? And you do this, then basically we converge to the optimal value as k gets large. And once I get the optimal value, then I can compute the optimal policy using the same idea. Convert value to policy by picking greedy policy corresponding to the value. Right? Convert any time I give you a value function, you can always convert into a policy function by picking the greedy policy. Okay? Okay. So actually, I want to do this, but before I do this, let me show you something kind of cute. If I can. Yep. So if you just look for value iteration applet, you'll get this. It's a Java applet. I accept the risk. Do not show this. Run. If it ever comes. Let's see. Seem to be happy. Oh, there it's coming. It says error. Reload. Well, what do you expect? Okay, I can try to do it here. It's working. Okay. Okay. So that's your MDP. It looks like a little MDP app, you know, it's like a little grid world, just the one like the one that we saw last earlier. And you can get here. I mean, if you just say value iteration applet, you'll get here. And then here is a whole bunch of description of what they're actually doing. So you should go and play with it yourself. You know, but I want to do, you know, like collectively look at it a little. So here basically, you know, I reset it right now. So currently it has no, you know, it essentially has rewards. So if I say step, the first time is when you will actually see the rewards. It turns out that this one has reward plus 10, and this one has reward minus 10, okay, and this one has reward minus 5, and this one has reward plus 3. So those are the only states which have rewards, and then every other state essentially I think has a small negative reward. If you read it somewhere here, they'll explain that every other state has a small negative reward, just like what we had in that, you know, original example. Okay. So now if you were to do Bellman backup on this, essentially what would happen? You know, you can see, so I can step through this. Notice that I have a discount factor of 0.9 here. Okay, I can change this. You can play with this at home. Okay, so if I step through this essentially and see what the numbers are changing, by the way, already some people think they have, previously every action is as good as every other action because all the neighbors had zero value. Just after one step, suddenly people started thinking that they know what action to do. Okay, and so basically if there's this one thinks that when I'm here I'm supposed to go this way. Right? Okay? And I keep changing, and then you want to keep your mind on which ones are changing as I step through. Okay? So there I go, I step. Do you see anything changing here anymore? Not really, right? Okay. And furthermore, you know, the numbers are still changing, but the policy essentially sort of not changing anymore. This tells you a lot of things. First of all, that the policy becomes optimal way before the value becomes optimal. Okay, this is the insight that the policy iteration algorithm tries to exploit. Okay, even before you reach the optimal value function, you already have reached the optimal policy in much fewer iterations. So if you somehow do your iterations in terms of the policy function, you might do less work. That's one insight we got. Okay, the other thing we got, of course, is it seems to be actually you know, converging quite fast in front of you, just a few iterations. Right? Now, what if I change the discount function? Suppose instead of 0.9, if I were to make the discount function 0.7, do you think the convergence will be faster or slower? How many people think slower? How many people think faster? Okay. How many people don't think? So basically, the best way to think about it is set beta equal to 0. Beta equal to 0, how much time does it take to converge? You're done. Right? It's like, there is no future. What are you telling me about future? There is no future. I'm dead. You see, beta equal to 0 is like saying k equal to 0. Think about this. Does this make sense to you? If k is if you have a finite horizon MDP with the horizon being 0, that is equivalent to saying beta equal to 0. Because there is no future. If there is no future, it turns out reasoning is fast. Cute, isn't it? If you believe you have no future, then you can reach the optimal decisions very fast, because whatever you get right now is the only thing you'll ever get. So immediate reward is your value function. Okay, so from that point of view, you know that as the discount factor decreases, the convergence speed increases. And similarly, if the discount factor increases, the convergence slows down. The worst case scenario, of course, is beta equal to 1, in which case actually it will never converge. In this particular case, beta equal to 1, it won't converge. You'll just keep going, and it'll just, the value function keeps going, growing without bound. Okay? Yes?
So how can you be sure that the solution does not converge the local optimal?
That's a very good question. That's what we'll have to show the theorem in a minute. Okay? Yes?
At the point with the six.
This one?
Yeah. The cross. Then it has a
six. Yeah.
Why? I thought it's supposed to be green here. It's supposed to point to the
No, no, it's just saying either of them are. Even if you do greedy, it's saying all four are equally good. That's all it's saying. By the way, the way it is, just 1 second. By the way, remember, notice that in each iteration, the way we wrote the algorithm is you keep going until the value function converges, and then you convert it into the policy, just once. But to make visualization simpler here, I am actually doing the inoptimal thing of at every point, whatever my current value function approximation is, I'm showing you the greedy policy corresponding to that, so that I can also see how the policy changes. By the way, this also tells you that the value iteration has this notion of the anytime. There is a set of algorithms that AI people just kind of drool over called anytime algorithms. An anytime algorithm is one which you can stop it anytime. I'll give you an answer, and the answer's quality will improve if you give it more time. You see what I'm saying? A non-anytime algorithm is if you stop it before it's completely done, it'll give you gobbledygook. It has no answer. By converting, if I stop value iteration at any particular time, I know a policy because I can convert that value function into the greedy policy. You see what I'm saying? Okay? So that's basically what I'm doing. In some sense, at each iteration, I just convert it into the value function so that at any time you know what the policy is. One more thing I want you to do, I'm going to reset this. This time I want you to just look at these guys. See what their values are doing. Okay? I am stepping now. What happened? You see what happened? So the value of each state eventually reaches its optimal value, but not in any monotonical fashion. Okay, in fact, there is a picture in the Russell book where he shows for every one of the states, as the number of iterations increase, how the value function converges for that state. So let's say for state S1, he'll show, okay, it's sort of eventually it's kind of going like this and it becomes this. This is V of S1. And it's going like this and converges. This is V of S2. As the number of iterations increase, the value of S1 and S2 stop changing after a while. What's interesting is what happens in the beginning. If you look at what happens in the beginning, the curves will look like this. Go look at the textbook. So in the beginning, they actually start falling down, for at least his example, and then start picking up. Again, it's quite intuitive as to what's happening here. At each iteration in Bellman backup, you look around your neighbors and see what's the best I can do. Originally, I had some idea, I'm kind of happy. So V0 of S is telling me, so VK of S is telling me that I think I am like 15 good. That means starting from this state, if I do optimal policy, I get 15 value. Then I look around and I find that all my neighbors think there are minus 7 good. Right? Then I'm delusional. Where do I get my 15 goodness if all my neighbors are minus 7 good? Do you understand what I'm saying? My value depends on my neighbor's value. And if all of them are minus 7, then I actually am not 15. I'm kind of more like minus 7. In fact, it's more, little worse than minus 7. Right? And then somebody else who was depending on me becomes even more depressed because I now went from 15 to minus 7. This keeps going until the message from the happy state starts percolating back. At some point of time, one of your neighbors starts saying, hey, I actually have a way out of this hellhole. Then I realize, it's not a hellhole anymore because I have a neighbor who knows how to get out of this hellhole. So that means I'm not in a hellhole. I too am happy. Okay, now here is the interesting thing. It's not that every state, this value that this guy is thinking of is not for any random action they can do. The value expects that you are doing the optimal action. If you do the optimal action, and if some neighbor has actually gotten out of this hellhole, then you too can reach your neighbor and get out of the optimal, you know, hellhole. When you are negative, that means even if you do the optimal action, you're still getting negative value. Because you have no neighbors who have ever made it out. No positive value for any of your neighbors. So what do you expect? Where do you expect your positive value to come? Okay? So that picture actually tells you that too. And again, this is quite obvious if you think about it. You know, basically this is how Bellman update is nothing but a local update of your value based on your neighbors. It's like the original spreadsheet algorithm. Right? It's just basically looking at its neighbors and it's rechanging its value function. And then when it changes next time around, then its neighbors will again change. Every iteration, people are changing their value functions and the message is passing backwards. That's what is happening in value iteration. Okay? You can play with this. You can do all sorts of things. In fact, in this particular case, it turns out since I did not click absorbing states, it turns out that you can actually, you know, in fact, thankfully, there is no action of hanging around in the state. Even if you are in heaven, apparently you can only stay for one epoch in heaven. Because I only have up, down, left, right. There is no up. Somebody was talking about, you know, if you're in a good state, why can't you just pitch a tent and hang around there? In this problem, there is no way of doing that because I didn't give you such an action. Okay, but in this problem, because I did not click absorbing states, essentially this plus 10, if you come back to it, you'll again get plus 10. If you come back to it, you'll again get plus 10. But remember, if I'm here and it took me 5 states to get to plus 10, then it is beta power 5 times 10. If it takes another 5 states to get back to 10, by that time it will be beta power 10 times 10. Beta is a number less than 1. So every time you come back, you are reducing the amount of value you are getting. You see what I'm saying? One of the nice things is if you have this is almost something that we mentioned earlier. Having a discount for the future is like setting a horizon. Even though you think there is no horizon, the discount factor is setting an effective horizon. Okay? Because of which, so it turns out that if you know, if you don't have discount factor and you do not have absorbing states, then people, the values can just keep increasing without bound. Because the summation of rewards can increase without bound. But because of beta, they cannot increase without bound. As long as beta is set to be less than 1. Strictly less than 1. Okay? So a technical issue is always how to make sure that the sum of rewards from any state is bounded. In the finite horizon case, you ensure that by saying it's a finite horizon. A finite sum can never be infinite if, in fact, you are summing over finite values. In the infinite horizon case, as long as you put a beta, you don't have to worry. The last one we will talk about next class is indefinite horizon case, where it is actually possible that you get very large behavior sequences, and you don't want to discount. And in that case, it's almost required that there be absorbing states. If there are no absorbing states, you will wind up basically just keep going, going, going. Okay? Okay. So that's basically your value iteration. And why does it converge? This is basically the reasoning. You have Bellman operation on value function, which, by the way, this operation itself is converting one value function, vk minus 1, to another value function, vk. this is basically whatever I did here, this is Bellman operation on Vk minus 1. So here Vk is B of Vk minus 1. Okay, so that's a shorthand notation. So the Bellman operator has this nice property called the contraction property, okay, where basically we can show, using the contraction property, we can show that if you start with any two value function, V and V dash, and apply the Bellman operator to both of them, then you effectively push them close to each other. If they were, you know, k distance away, now they'll be beta times k distance away, where beta is less than 1. So it'll become closer and closer. Now the interesting thing is, if you consider that, and if I think that V is actually V star, so this holds for any two value functions, V and V dash. Okay? It holds for any two value functions. You pick any two value functions, you apply Bellman operator to both of them, the distance between them reduces after the operation. Okay? So, without loss of generality, now I can say one of them is V star. I don't know what V star is yet, but I know that there is a V star, okay, which is optimal value function. So now I can do the following thing. I can say, originally, let's say I have V and V star, and V is, you know, some distance away from V star. Now I apply Bellman operation to V star, and also apply Bellman operation to V. Now, if you apply Bellman operation to V star, what will happen? What will happen? It'll be V star, right? By mathematics, that's because it's a fixed point. I mean, V star is defined as the fixed point of the Bellman operator, right? So essentially, you will wind up getting V star minus BV. This is guaranteed to be, as long as I can show you the contraction property, it's going to be guaranteed to be less than or equal to beta times V star minus V. So irrespective of what value function I started with, if I do one Bellman backup on it, it becomes a little closer to V star. And I get a new value function. Now this was already a little closer to V star than the original one, remember. Now I do a Bellman operation on this again, which is what the value iteration is doing, then it becomes even a little more closer to V star. So that's essentially the technical reason as to why value iteration converges. Okay? Now, the part that I still want to show you, which is kind of cute, I mean, if you understand this much, it's good enough for this class. But you still want to know, why is this property true? Why is it that Bellman operation actually has contraction property? Contraction properties are general properties of functions, and it turns out that you can prove that Bellman operation has it starting from here. Okay, so follow me here. For any arbitrary function f of a, and any arbitrary function g of a, okay, you can see that the distance between the maximum value of f and the maximum value of g, okay, has to be less than or equal to the max of fa minus ga. And to see that, look at these pictures. Here is my f. Here's my g. This is just an example, but I mean, you should be able to understand what I wrote there. But in this example, okay, what is max value of f? This. Right? This is the max value of f. What is the max value of g? This. So this side is this distance from here, so basically from here to here. That's the distance. Okay, now if you take FA minus GA, it'll actually be the highest here. If you take the FA minus GA function and find its max value, it'll be the highest here, and you can see that it's actually less than the other one. Okay, so max over a function A minus max over function B is always less than or equal to max over the difference of the original functions. This is just true. And starting from this, you can essentially work out on our functions, the Bellman operators, and get the result we want. So in this particular case, we can use it to show that, so here B, where am I? Okay. Bellman operator on value function V is this, right? I'm just writing my Bellman operation on any value function. And Bellman operation on V dash is this. So if I subtract BV minus BV dash F, okay, this has to be, this is basically, I'm going to subtract on this side, that'll be beta of this max minus this max. So this is a max of something minus max of another thing. That whole thing would be less than or equal to max of the difference. Okay? Yes?
To prove that it's really convergent, so to prove that V star minus V is less than epsilon, what is the difference between saying that V star minus V is less than epsilon and to say that the distance always reduces?
I did tell you that the distance is reducing because this is the distance between, you know, V star and V, which is basically, so if V star, let's say it's a three-state MDP, okay, and let's say V star is 7, 14, 5 for the three states, okay? The current V is 4, 20, and, you know, 5. Okay, then if you take the difference, it would basically be 3 here and minus 6 here and 0 here. I take the max, absolute max of any of the differences. So in this particular case, 6 is the max difference. So 6 is the distance between these two vectors. All I am saying is if 6 is the distance between these two vectors, and if I were to do Bellman backup on this and Bellman backup on this, I'll get two other value functions. If I compute their distance, it would be less than or equal to beta times 6. So as long as beta is less than 1, I've reduced the distance. Okay? So that's basically, what else do you want? Okay, that's basically why the value iteration works from the point of view of the contraction property. And if I have any, at any given point of time, if I have a value function, I can convert into a greedy policy. And so if I do value iteration until the value function between two iterations, the difference between the value function between the two iterations is less than or equal to epsilon, then I can stop there. Okay, and at that point I have what I, basically what I have is a, what I, that would be my approximation to the value function. Okay, optimal value function. Then I can convert it into the optimal policy by essentially taking the greedy policy with respect to that value function. Greedy policy says for every state, for every action, compute the expected backed up value, expected backed up reward, expected backed up value, and then pick the action that gives the maximum of that. Okay? So that's how you act once you have value iteration. Now, as I said, greedy policy essentially, and you can actually show that, as I said, greedy only for the greedy policy of the optimal, greedy policy of the optimal value function is also optimal policy. For everywhere else, this relation is not guaranteed. In fact, the greedy policy of inoptimal value function can be optimal. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I haven't yet reached the optimal value function. I have some approximation right now. So I take the greedy policy with respect to that. That may already be optimal policy. This is basically the insight for policy iteration. Because if you think in terms of policies, you converge faster than if you think in terms of values. Okay. But you can actually put, what this is showing is if the value function is within beta of the optimal value function, then the policy you get, the greedy policy with respect to this value function, cannot be more than this away from the optimal policy. Now, how do you compare policies? How do you compare policies? You know how to compare values, because when I said in this particular case, if Vk is within epsilon of V star, what did I mean by that? If Vk is within V star, what did I mean by that? Essentially, what I meant is that. So this is Vk, this is V, let's say this is V star, this is Vk, and then I'm taking the difference, I'm taking the max norm, that means the maximum value of the difference in any dimension, taking the absolute value there. And if it is within epsilon, if epsilon is 0.01, that means the maximum difference in any dimension is bounded by 0.01. That's pretty good. Now, if that is the case, then I can, for example, for V star, I could have computed pi star, which is basically going to be the optimal policy. For V, I can also compute the greedy policy. Okay, the question is, how far is the greedy policy going to be away from the optimal policy? And when I'm comparing policies, I will again compare the value function. The way you policies have actions. How do you differentiate between, suppose, so this, in this particular case, let's say this is the value function. The policy function for this may have been A7, A9, A4. And policy function for this may have been A8, A9, A7. What's the difference? What's the distance between these? That depends on, I understand, this zero distance. What's the distance between A7 and A8? What's the distance between apple and orange? I have no idea. However, if this is your policy, you can evaluate the policy using the original idea I told you. And you can also evaluate this policy. Okay? Compute the distance between the value function. That is the policy difference. And what this is saying is if V star and Vg are, V star and Vk are within epsilon of each other, then the greedy value corresponding to the greedy policy will be 2 epsilon times beta by 1 minus beta away from V star. Okay? So notice, is this going to be bigger or smaller than epsilon? Because, so consider, so if epsilon is 0.1, let's say, then this is 2 times 0.1, then you need a beta. Okay? If you have beta 0.9, it's 0.9 by 0.1. Right? That's what you have. So this is basically saying, I got a new epsilon now. The greedy value actually cannot be farther away from optimal value by this much, if the original Vk is 0.1 away from V star. Okay, but notice that x by 1 minus x is what we are talking about. Right? X by 1 minus x.
1 minus x.
And the point I'm trying to make is it's not always x by 1 minus x. The value of x by 1 minus x depends on x. Right? If x is 0, x by 1 minus x is 0. If x is 1, x by 1 minus x is infinity. right? You pick 0.9, in the 0.9 case, it's actually more distance. But in fact, what this is telling us, I'm not going to do this right now. What I'm telling you is there is a way of computing the threshold, the new epsilon between the greedy value and the V star. And that's not necessarily going to be worse than the epsilon. It can actually be less than the epsilon. Okay? Okay, I'll just mention this and then we'll go back. I guess we have to meet next class. We'll talk about policy iteration stochastic shortest path. One thing that, so basically value iteration is made as if it is actually just, it's just like finite domain, it's a finite horizon MDP. That's the way we set it. So we always computed Vk from Vk minus 1, Vk plus 1 from Vk. These are called synchronous iterations. That means everybody update, everybody look around, update your values based on your neighbors. Now everybody again look around, update your values based on your neighbors. That's what value iteration is doing. Now, if this is implemented in some sort of a decentralized fashion such that each state has its own little CPU, then this is fine. If in fact there is one CPU which is going around updating every state's value, then there is going to be a difference between synchronous versus asynchronous value iteration. In the asynchronous value iteration, what I would say is not everybody needs to update their values every time. You want to update the values of those states that are likely to change a lot in this current iteration. And once the message goes, then the other guys can start changing their values. In the picture that I showed you, remember the guys in this top left-hand corner? The first few iterations, they're wasting their time updating their values because they're actually going down, even though eventually they'll start going up. They may as well have taken a coffee break for a while the good message or the bad message traverses up to them. Okay? So, basically, asynchronous value iteration says you can essentially update the values of states in any which order you want. They don't all have to do it synchronously. And if the original value iteration is going to converge, which we just showed it does, then the asynchronous value iteration will also converge as long as you are willing to update every state infinitely often. It's just that, you know, that your infinity might come 15 days after. And the asynchronous value iteration turns out to be a much, much better idea than synchronous value iteration. Those of you, for example, who know PageRank algorithm, basically can actually look at a variation of this for PageRank. You know, not everybody's PageRank has to be computed every iteration for the stable PageRank. Okay, so the prioritized sweeping algorithms essentially try to estimate which states are likely to change their values a lot and then focus on those states up front. And then, you know, slowly the other guys, you know, will start getting updated too. By doing this, value iteration can be made much faster than the synchronous one. And the other idea that I already mentioned, while value iteration would work irrespective of which initial value you started with, if you start with a value that is closer to V star, you will take fewer iterations. And that way, if you have some approximate way, some heuristic way of computing how good states are, and you use that H value to, you know, make V0 equal to H of S, V0 of S equal to H of S, then the value iteration takes much fewer iterations. Okay? When we come back next class, we'll talk about this policy iteration that I kept mentioning many times because policies seem to converge faster than value, and then talk about stochastic shortest path MDPs, which is a third type of MDP. We talked about finite horizon MDP, infinite horizon MDP, and stochastic shortest path MDP, which allows indefinite horizon. And it turns out that theoretically, it subsumes both finite horizon and infinite horizon. So if you're given a finite horizon, you can convert into a stochastic shortest path MDP. If you're given an infinite horizon, you can convert into a stochastic shortest path MDP. And then we'll try to understand how to do value iteration for that.